Hello, and thank you for joining me this week on Lutheran Answers. I had the wonderful pleasure back in October of interviewing the amazing Hans Feeney. And Hans was kind enough to agree to an interview with me, and I am so pleased with how it came out. Probably one of the best interviews that I have done so far on Lutheran Answers. So that's it. Let's get right into it. I'm not even going to waste your time. I hope you enjoy this interview. You know what to do. Hit that bump music.
Meet you as well.
Kind of for real, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Pastor, welcome to Lutheran Satire. Nope, never mind. We're going to start that over. Welcome to Lutheran Answers. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me.
It's my pleasure. I mean, there are way too many podcasts, but yours is one of them.
Indeed. So. It's always good to scream into the void.
Yes.
Whenever you can.
As much screaming into the void as we can possibly get.
Yeah.
That's ideal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So.
But yeah, no, glad to be here.
Thank you. So, you know, you're pretty well known on the internet. I think most people know you either for terrible bread takes on Twitter or from not being at the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
Right. Yeah, that is.
What most people may not know is that you have a successful YouTube channel called Lutheran Satire.
I do, yeah. I would have given it a better name if I had planned on it becoming what it ended up becoming. So,
what are the alternate name ideas?
I've never thought about any what they would be. I just know that the name it has is not very creative and is very direct. But then again, people are stupid, so it helps if you just call your thing exactly what it is. So, like, you know how, like, the Babylon Bee keeps getting banned from social media?
Yeah.
Because morons think that it's real.
Yeah.
But if they had called themselves Fake Christian News or something stupid like that, you know, then maybe they wouldn't have that problem. So, yeah, so I started it about a little over 10 years ago. It originally kind of started as me just doing jokes about kind of liturgical type of battles in LCMS culture. And then I fairly quickly discovered that there was something valuable to it beyond just kind of taking shots at my friends and neighbors and in the LCMS. And so that it had a kind of a broader teaching value. So I kind of expanded it to that and would just cover a variety of topics. And one of my favorite things about it is whenever I do a video on where I'm deliberately criticizing a certain doctrine, whichever group of people holds to that doctrine will say, "I thought all of your other videos were hilarious, but this one is just stupid.
Too far. This one's beyond the pale."
Yeah, so that I'm not at all surprised. You know how comedians talk about how wokeness has ruined comedy and how they can't go to college campuses anymore and crack jokes? That doesn't surprise me, because I noticed that from the very beginning with Lutheran Satire, was that if you made fun of whatever people held sacred, then they would get mad. And what was weird to me about it, though, was the name of the channel is Lutheran Satire.
Right.
So why did you think, so when the Calvinists would get mad at me for making fun of Calvinism, like, why did you think I held to the limited atonement? I told you what I am in the title, in the very unoriginal and boring name of my YouTube channel. But yeah, I've been doing that for about 10 years now.
My one of my favorite videos is the C-3PO attends a Pentecostal revival.
Oh, thank you.
Video. I grew up Pentecostal holiness, so
okay.
It was the first time seeing that video was a bit of a shock, But then ultimately funny because, like, it's really like that.
Yeah.
It's really like that. And, like, the you know, you do all the different gibberish and he's like, you know, oh, no, that was just, you know, Hebrew sounding gibberish. And, like, it's really like that where people are like, oh, man, I must have been speaking Hebrew. You know.
Right.
Yeah, no. I showed that to my mom and she thought it was hilarious, too.
Well, I'm glad that your mom liked it. That makes me happy.
Yeah.
My grandparents-in-law are actually in the video. They are two of the characters, not voice actors, but two of the older couple in the video were designed after my wife's grandparents, which makes me happy every time I see the video.
I'm sure they're very appreciative.
I explained to them that happened. And I'm not sure that they remembered, but I do know that there's a guy at their church who very much likes Lutheran satire who came in and was all excited telling him, like, you guys are characters in a thing. And I don't know if they had watched that video or even really would have gotten it because I don't. They were obviously around when Star Wars came out, but I would be surprised if they had any frame of reference for C-3PO and how that fit into the broader scheme of criticizing Pentecostal silliness.
Which it is, the Pentecostalism. Yeah. Do you think humor, I mean, obviously the answer to this is yes, so let me ask it better. Why do you think humor is such a valuable tool for catechesis?
I think it can be very helpful because when you say things with tongue in cheek, for kind of two reasons. When you say things tongue-in-cheek, that enables you to come a lot closer to saying something sort of free of criticism. So you can come a lot closer. It's like guys who are, you know, when male friendships, right, are oftentimes rooted in guys being mean to each other. Mm-hmm. That you're closer to a guy, the more terrain you have to insult him.
So
when you're able to get closer, you are able to pick things apart more. And so you're able to kind of get away with saying things that people might otherwise be offended by, but by doing it in kind of a comedic way, they don't take it always that seriously. And then the other thing is, by using humor, you're oftentimes able to pick things apart in a very brief and kind of systematic way that you might not otherwise be. So if you're able to pull in analogies, if you're able to pull in jokes, things of that nature. So for example, with the C-3PO visits a Pentecostal revival video, that was a big thing. And that's one of my kind of chief criticisms of the Pentecostal movement and Pentecostal church bodies is how people will just move the goalposts.
Yeah.
Where, you know, so they claim that they are speaking in a language, and then if you can show them that it's not a language, then they just go, oh, well, then it must have been, you know, some special prayer language I was speaking in. So you're able to kind of make those accusations in a way that's not personal because the people that you're depicting are not actually real. So I typically don't like to go after actual individuals, unless they're really, really public figures, you know, like guys like Joel Osteen and some of the other televangelist hucksters and stuff like that, or the Pope.
Right.
But, you know, individual people who go to, you know, Joe Schmo who goes to a Pentecostal church, I don't want to pick on him. So it's, you do it in a way where it enables you to get to what people believe and to kind of pick it apart, so to hopefully show them and to show others why this doesn't work and why this doesn't fit, basically. So I think humor is ultimately helpful with that.
Do you find, we're talking to, you know, it's harder, comedians say, like you mentioned, to make jokes anymore. People are more and more offended. Do you find, like, with catechism class every year, like, does it get a little harder to work your way through?
Not in a sense of humor or in a sense of worrying about people being offended. It's teaching catechism now is harder because every 3 weeks the secular left invents a new sexual transgression that didn't even exist 5 seconds ago, and then then you have to teach kids that that's wrong.
Right. Right?
So I remember talking to my dad once, and
also a pastor.
He retired, and then he came out of retirement. But he was going to, you know, going into retirement, and I was saying how I was jealous of him, not so much because he was done working, or at least done working in a kind of full-time capacity, mm-hmm. but because I know that at some point in the relatively near future, I'm going to have to actually teach my youth confirmation class that when they get older, they can't use sex robots and like insane, you know, just utterly right. insane things like that.
Yeah.
That my dad didn't have when I was in confirmation, it was like, don't, you know, the sixth commandment mean, you know, to lead a sexually pure and decent life means don't commit adultery. It means don't have sex before you're married. Don't look at pornography and, turn away from your lust. But people are, especially when it comes to teaching people the law, they need specifics. They will not, people will not make the 2 + 2 = 4 connection that you think is right there in front of them. You have to kind of make that for them. So you have to say this stuff, right? It's in a lot of ways, I think it's why, a lot of ethical issues in the church, things kind of get out of hand and lay people get so confused when this could have easily been headed off at the pass if pastors had talked about it beforehand and been clear about it. For example, one of these things would be surrogate pregnancy. I remember getting my hair cut once, and the lady who was cutting my hair I was talking about how my wife and I were foster parents, and she was asking why we got into it. And I had said, well, you know, we always wanted to have more kids, but my wife had very difficult pregnancies. So that was ultimately not going to be an option. And she said, well, there's always surrogacy. And I said, oh, yeah, no, I have moral objections to renting a woman's womb. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, I guess I never thought of it as being renting a woman's womb. Yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I think that just means you never thought about it. And right. I didn't, and like not as a criticism of her, but you just never sat down for a minute and just thought about what is actually happening here. Mm-hmm. And it was a conversation where in the matter of 3-4 minutes I was able to convince her that's not a thing that people should do. That's a bad idea. And so you think people will make those connections, but they don't. And they need you to do that for them. And so that is much more so like the wokeness and wokeness is not a natural thing for teenage kids. It's a foreign worldview that's foisted upon them. And mm-hmm. if they embrace it, it becomes a problem. But there's a lot of indoctrination that has to happen first before they really get to that point. For the most part, when they're at kind of confirmation age, they have a very sort of they haven't been trained to completely reject every aspect of natural law, and they haven't been trained not to trust their gut reaction to things that are vile and unnatural. Yeah. So in a lot of ways, that's a lot easier. It's just that you have to figure out how to teach your youth confirmation class and not have the sixth commandment take up 45% of the class. Because a few years ago, I didn't have to teach kids about gender theory.
Right.
But now I do, because it's everywhere.
It's wild, too. Like you mentioned, you know, one day I'm going to have to explain that sex robots are not okay.
Right. Right.
And that's something that your father probably wouldn't have even been able to conceptualize.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Like it's not even something you can imagine until it happens.
Right. Yeah. That's what's been so weird about wokeness is that I feel like in previous years, you know, conservatives always kind of got criticized making arguments that people call the slippery slope argument. So, if you legalize this, then this thing is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But one of the fascinating things about the last few years is there's so many things that just come out of left field and you're going, I didn't even know that was on the slope. I didn't see that at the bottom of the ski slope. And yet it kind of just gets thrown upon you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just this whole concept of, people inventing their own genders. Mm-hmm. So it's the most narcissistic thing in the world. I keep seeing these videos. I'm not on TikTok, but I see TikTok videos posted onto Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, some dude is explaining, I saw one the other day, some guy's explaining his, his gender slash sexual identity. I don't even remember the name of it, but it was someone who likes watching sexual material but doesn't want to participate in it.
And that's just a porn addiction.
Yeah, and a friend of mine said, I think that's, you just invented a term for porn addicted loser.
Right.
That's not an identity, or the one demisexual, right, which is someone who is not sexually attracted to someone that they have not developed an emotional bond with. And you look at it and you go, that's called being a normal woman.
Right.
Called being a non-promiscuous lady. That's what that is. You invented a marginalized term for being normal.
Yeah,
and well, that is.
I saw one the other day. I say the other day. It was like months ago now, but it was like you know what we need is a system that holds men accountable to their partners and their children. And I was like, it's marriage. We have that.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. I saw a tweet that was great where someone basically said every now and then the left accidentally reverse engineers marriage and thinks that they've discovered something.
Yeah, it's like fire new to them.
Right. Yeah.
It's pretty wild. When I was growing up, my best friend was a Muslim kid named Muntasir, and very cool guy. And it wasn't a big deal growing up because it was like pre 9/11 and no one really knew what Islam was, or if they did, they didn't really care, you know. And his mom was a doctor and his dad was a Papa John's franchisee or something, Domino's franchisee, something like that. And we'd always go, you know, I'd go over to their house and they'd order cheese pizza for them and they'd order a pepperoni pizza for me, you know. And it was just, we were best friends, you know, growing up. And he used to always say, whenever I would suggest something, hey, you want to go do this? If he didn't want to do it, he would say, oh, well, no, that's against my religion.
No.
And now here I am 20 years later, and I find myself not ironically, but like seriously, people will suggest things like at work. And I'm like, oh, well, that's against my religion. You know, like, oh, hey, we're all going to the strip club later. That's against my religion. And it's weird. It's weird to like actually say that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I've often said that one of the challenges of being a Christian, and this is less so becoming the case, but is that if you it's sort of like training for a marathon. If you just sit on the couch all day and eat potato chips and pasta, that's not a great way to train for a marathon. So when the time comes to run a marathon, you'll just quit pretty early on. And because the investment is, you haven't remotely built your way up to that.
Right.
And one of the problems I've kind of diagnosed in typical, I've most of my parish life has been in suburban congregations. So kind of life in the suburbs. One of the things that you frequently find is that, especially with younger people, the times in their life when they turn away from the Christian faith are generally the times in their life when they are first asked to sacrifice something for their faith. So whether it's, I've certainly known of cases where young ladies have grown up in the church their whole life and they've heard 80 billion times that you're not supposed to live with someone that you're not married to, that that's a sin, and that the pastor will have to talk with you about that if that becomes an issue. And then they move in with their boyfriend, and then they say, hey, we want to get married. The pastor goes, all right, well, we got to talk about this. And then they just immediately quit and leave and won't have a conversation with you, because essentially that girl's been planning the production of the wedding in her brain since she was 5 years old. And then the pastor comes along and says, no, you need to sacrifice some aspect of your dream wedding because of your faith. And then she just kind of looks at it and goes, oh, well, then I don't want this.
Yeah.
You know? And I think you see something similar just in a general sense when it comes to people start recognizing once they get into the professional world, for example, that if you actually hold to your beliefs about any number of issues, that could cost you your job, that could cost you any kind of upward mobility. When it comes to parents, talking with parents about where their kids go to college, and saying, hey, look, there's no good church for your kid to go here. So to go to here. So maybe you should reevaluate. And they just kind of look at you like, well, of course they're not going to go to church in college. Why on earth would they do that?
What's really important here, Pastor?
Right. And you go, oh, well, you know, having a good congregation to go to at the time of your life when you're sort of most going to be under attack from the devil of having your faith destroyed would probably be a good time to make sure that you have a good congregation to go to. But the idea that you wouldn't go to the college that you want to go to, the idea that you wouldn't take a job somewhere because there's no faithful church for you to go to, the idea that you wouldn't, that you don't buy something because you need to, you know, whether it's your house, you don't buy the house that you want to have, you don't max yourself out on your mortgage for your house or for your car payments or whatever it is so that you can actually have money to give to the poor. All of that, people don't, they, when you don't grow up having anything that you sacrifice, and all of a sudden someone says, hey, that really huge, massive, important thing in your life, don't have that because of your faith. And in a strange sort of way, it does make me envy the Muslims. It makes me envy practicing Jews. It makes me envy people who have little things in their lives, oftentimes dietary things. Mm-hmm. Where they basically, they just get used to, on account of what I believe, on account of who I am, there are certain things I don't do that the rest of the world may do. And now, as I said earlier, I think that's changing. I think we're getting to the point where Christianity is going to be so kind of culturally ghettoized that's a much more natural thing that happens to us. I mean, we're basically getting to the point where it's spiritually suicidal to put your kids in public schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, things of that nature. So that, you know, could certainly solve quite a bit of it. But it is a it's a challenge when people don't have that in smaller ways, because the smaller ways build up strength for the bigger and the more in the more important ways. And I think the more that we have of that, the more that we recognize that as Christians, there's certain I think you saw this in recent years, like with the popularity of shows like Game of Thrones, and mm-hmm. and if people ever suggested, hey, there's a ton of naked people on that show all the time. There's just a ton of gross, disgusting violence. Maybe this is not material that Christians should really be consuming. And people would just immediately freak out and leap to accusations of legalism. And you go, I'll agree that somewhere there's a line of you're being legalistic by telling people they can't watch certain stuff. But not that long ago, you would have gone to jail for putting on TV what a lot of people put on TV right now. So the line is probably comes sooner than later, right? The line is certainly hardcore pornography is over the line for Christians.
Right.
But I think the line is probably somewhere a good amount of distance before that.
Right.
I don't know exactly where it is, but I'm pretty sure it's there.
Well, and when talking about our mortal soul, it's probably better to be cautious, right? Like I'd rather stop too soon than stop an inch over the line.
Right. And I think probably a more important question to ask ourselves is not even so much is this stuff okay for Christians to watch, but the more important question is this beneficial for Christians to watch? Mm. Does this actually benefit us in any way? Do you gain something from this that is beneficial to your soul in any way, shape, or form? And I think you'd be hard-pressed to make an argument for a lot of that stuff that's the case.
So you had a video on the Lutheran satire. Tyler the ex-evangelical or whatever.
Yes. Someone suggested to me, Someone suggested to me I should have called it I Kissed Swimming Goodbye. But I didn't.
Change the name of it.
I think, I can in the YouTube title, but not in the actual, in the actual video itself. That's one of the only things that I get annoyed at with people is when someone will, if people write me emails and say, hey, I like your Lutheran satire stuff, that's great. If they write it and they go, hey, I think this was an unfair criticism, that's fine. I'm happy to have a conversation about that. But if they write to me and say, I noticed your video from 3 years ago. Hi, Levi. My son just walked into the room. If they write to me and they say, I noticed your video from 3 years ago has a typo in it. So if you want to fix that. And I just have to go, I don't think you know how videos work. I can't go into an uploaded thing. It is not like a live blog. So you're just, Levi's just jumping up and down.
That's great.
That's okay. So what were we talking about?
So Tyler.
Oh, Tyler. Swimming. Yeah. Tyler, the ex-evangelical. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So in the video, there's this point where he's talking about, you know, no one has the answers to these questions. And you know, it's like, right. This is all we talk about down here. Why have you never come down here? At what point, though, do the people in the deep end have a responsibility, you think, to swim over to the shallow end and say, hey, let's talk about these questions? I saw someone on Twitter bemoaning the fact that they're like, oh, the congregation doesn't want to learn good, real theology. And like, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. I think congregations tend to take on the personalities of their pastors. Mm. And it's the same thing I see with, it's like whenever anyone says to me, oh, kids don't like hymns. What they're just saying to me is, I don't like hymns.
Right. Yeah.
So they're just taking whatever their preferences are and transferring them onto kids. So, you know, I don't watch baseball. My kids don't really care about baseball. I really like football. My kids really like football. So that's just kind of the way that things work. And pastors have obviously a fatherly role in the congregation. And over time, it's not just that they pick up on your interests, but they pick up on your enthusiasm, and that so when you care about things and when you find things fascinating, they find them fascinating. So I don't think it's at all true that people. I mean, there are some people, sure, who are shallow, and some people who are there for some reason other than doctrine. But I certainly think that if pastors actually take the lead and if they speak about doctrine in a way where they're able to kind of pull people into the deeper waters, it's not that difficult to do. I mean, there are some people who have an intellectual capacity that you can't raise up, and that's fine. But you can still speak to them about the depth of things in a way that they're going to understand. So I think that's certainly the case. But obviously, what's always kind of the case in those ex-evangelical testimonies is they're always and it's the most frustrating thing in the entire world because it's so transparent. Mm-hmm. I had to leave Christianity. I just had to do it. That's the thing that always drives me nuts. Yeah. Is this sort of the truth pulled me away from what I wanted to believe, which is never the case. And then they always divorce their wives three weeks later.
Underlying.
So, right, yeah. So you're going, well, that was actually the thing, man. Like, you wanted this thing over here, mm-hmm. and you knew you had to get rid of Jesus in order to get it. So, but that's always the thing, is that it's just, yeah, going to these theological questions that people have been offering answers to for thousands of years,
yeah,
and that the Bible itself offers answers to, and that theologians in every century since the scriptures were written have been offering answers to these questions. And just the lack of curiosity, I think, shows that, I guess this is it, you know, Lutherans oftentimes talk about, when we talk about the Eighth Commandment, according to the proper numbering of the commandments, and do not bear false witness against your neighbor, and Lutherans from Luther's Small Catechism have always made a big deal about putting the best construction on things, so that you honor and protect your neighbor's reputation by assuming the best in when you consider the things that he's done. But sometimes people put you in a situation where you say, well, putting the best construction on things, I don't know how to do it because my options are either you're a liar or you're stupid. And you tell me which of those you think is the best construction, and I'll go with whichever one you say. So either you're lying when you say no one could answer these questions that I had, because there are a million people that have offered answers that are right in front of you, and you can't even begin to articulate what any of those answers would be. So either you're lying and you're just pretending that no one was addressing the things that you're claiming were the reason you left Christianity, or you're so completely self-absorbed that you just assumed you knew everything. And so no, why would I read a book that someone else wrote?
Yeah.
You know, like, why would I, it's like going to France and just being like, I don't understand. Like, how could I possibly have known that I would not know what people were going to say? You know, like, well, did you read a book about like French stuff and language and stuff? Like, no, I just never once thought about it and went there and then this happened. How could this possibly have happened to me? Well, that's probably your fault. So, yeah, it's a strange habit that I think is largely caused by the cult of personality in evangelicalism. That it's built up not around confessions of faith, but around personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, well, then people buy their own hype, and then everything falls apart.
It's interesting. I have been watching this discussion that Dr. Jordan Cooper has been having, because he took a jab at people that say like they needed to like deconstruct their faith or whatever. This one guy deconstructed his faith to the point that he left the faith entirely, and was like he wanted people to like he wanted Christians to respect that and be proud of that, and like, oh, well, what's right for you is right for, but like, that's not like, do you not know what we think? Like, you were here, you were in the camp. How do you not understand? Like, no one's cheering you on for choosing damnation.
Right. Yeah. And you can see that kind of narcissism in there is because they ultimately think people love me because of who I am, rather than, and it's not that people don't in my congregation, of course the people love me for who I am, but they're not there because of me. They're there because I deliver Christ to them. That's that is such, I've experienced that same thing with people where they turn away from the faith, generally for some really obvious sex related reason, or some, you know, something equally sort of shallow and obvious.
Yeah.
And then they expect you to be proud of them for having gone on this journey.
Yeah.
And you're going, oh, no. I'm not happy for you.
Not impressed
at all. It's very odd to me. I got into a minor argument with a fella on the internet the other day who was a former LCMS Lutheran who became Eastern Orthodox.
Oh, geez.
And I made a comment, and it was a snarky one that it was about some other Lutheran pastor who'd become Orthodox, and I was responding to one of his arguments for why he was let out of Lutheranism, and his argument indicated that it was one of these situations, either you never really learned what it was, or you deliberately crafted a straw man, silly, shallow version of it so that you could justify walking away from it. And I said that this is like when a guy decides that he wants to leave his wife for a woman that he finds more attractive, and that's the reason, and then just sort of retroactively creates a reason for it. Because in a lot of guys I know that have gone to Orthodoxy, that their reasons for they can't even sort of tell you their reasons, and they you can just kind of tell that they wanted, as I think Will Wheaton, I saw this quote of his that put this well, and I'm not going to do it justice, but it was basically they compare the ugliness of Lutheranism to the beauty of Orthodoxy. So they just kind of take all of the stuff, they look at all of our problems, and then they pretend that just the beautiful facade of Orthodoxy that they see is what it really is.
Yeah, well, it's too strong in there.
Right. Yeah. And so then, and then they try to kind of reverse engineer a reason for why they left. But the funny thing to me about this guy getting upset was he said, well, I'm sure that when people, if anyone came to you from Orthodoxy, you wouldn't tell them that their reasons for leaving weren't legitimate. And so he expected me to play, have the same rules for both right. sides, that right. to have the same degree of skepticism for people who leave Orthodoxy for Lutheranism than I do for people that leave Lutheranism for Orthodoxy. And I just said, look, you seem to have forgotten. I mean, you were part of our group, so I figured you knew this, but let me make it clear. I believe that we're right.
Right.
So I believe that this is the faith. The faith that I confess is the faith that the Holy Spirit gives to you. So I don't believe that the Holy Spirit leads people away from the truth and into error. And because of that, anyone who tells you, oh, I was genuinely convinced of the arguments of Orthodoxy, I don't believe that person, because you can't be genuinely convinced by something the Bible doesn't teach.
Right.
So there has to be something else that's actually leading you away, even if you yourself are firmly and entirely convinced that it was for legitimate theological reasons. But what was so strange to me about it was, of course I have different standards for people leaving Lutheranism than I do for people joining it.
Yeah,
why would
I make it hard to get in my group?
Right, like what? Right, and I think I'm right. Yeah. That's why I'm the thing that I am. I wouldn't be a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod if I didn't think we were right. So you should expect people who think they're right to have the to think the way that right people do, to have those standards. This is not politics. This is not people arguing about their favorite movies. This is the doctrine of God that's either given to you by the Holy Spirit, or it's false doctrine that's given to you by the devil. Those are your two options.
I heard once a long time ago, and it's really stuck with me, that humans are not rational creatures, we're rationalizing creatures. And the difference between those two things is, you know, pretty yes. severe.
Yeah, and there's a great quote floating around, I don't remember who it's from, but it's always apropos in politics, that you can't reason people out of something they weren't reasoned into.
Mm.
So if people did not have a rational or logical reason for embracing something, using reason and logic to convince them to walk back from that isn't going to work. And I think that's often true.
How do you guard against these things as a pastor? Just like, how do you handle this kind of stuff?
What kind of stuff specifically?
People wanting to walk away for bogus reasons. People leaving for Orthodoxy or atheism or whatever.
I think that you, on the one hand, you have to always start off trusting in the Word of God. So sure, you can't reason people out of something that they weren't reasoned into, but at the same time, the Word of God is the Word of God, and the Holy Spirit will create and build back up faith where and when it pleases Him to do so. And my job as a pastor, something that I think all pastors should keep in mind, is your job is not to be effective. Mm. Your job is to confess the truth and then to leave everything in God's hands. Now, of course, that doesn't mean be an idiot and be a jerk and just give people information and then walk away. You know, obviously, you have to listen to people. And a lot of pastoral care is figuring out what is the pain that's causing people to turn away from the Word, which is oftentimes a big aspect of things. Like, what is the devil putting into someone's heart that's causing them to reject the thing that they had formerly embraced? So that doesn't necessarily mean that that knowing the answer to that is going to give you sort of the magical words to say to keep someone from, to bring someone back. But in the end, I think it's just a matter of be faithful, speak the truth, recognize that God is God and you're not, and that he will accomplish his will where and when it pleases him to do so. But that if you warn people, as you know, as the scriptures say, if you warn people to turn from their sins and they come back, then God be praised. And if you warn people and they leave, it's their blood is not on your hands.
Right.
So it's only when you don't speak the word faithfully that that the Lord is going to hold you accountable for that.
I guess it's sort of I have similar ideas about like church growth, you know. Mm-hmm. That thankfully my congregation is wonderful and we don't have this problem. Our main I don't even think we really have a church growth strategy at all at my congregation, which is, it's a blessing. It's wonderful. We just like feed people and, you know, mm-hmm. just kind of go from there. But I see a lot of people talk about, oh, well, you know, maybe we should eject this part of the liturgy or replace the old sad hymns with the fancy Hillsong music or whatever. And it's like, I don't know, like you kind of want to say, it's not really, that's not your, like, church growth. Yeah, you should be responsible with your church, you know, and everything God has given you. But also at the same time, like, it's not your church, right? It's God's.
Right, yeah. And, yeah, I mean, there's obviously a certain degree of human wisdom in these things where really simple stuff, right? Like, people are more likely to come to your church if they know that it exists.
Right.
So this is one of my criticisms of, well, mostly now dead Lutherans. But cheap Germans loved to buy cheap property that wasn't on the main street in town. Mm-hmm. You're going, oh, wow, yeah, heaven forbid that people in your community know that you exist, right? So you should, so if you have the choice between two pieces of property, maybe give a bit more money where you can actually be on the main street in town. And you should be present. The church should be doing things. You should be active in your community, mm-hmm. and whatnot, so that people, if nothing else, just simply know that you're there.
Yeah.
And you should be engaged in works of mercy, and in feeding and clothing the poor in your community and things of that nature as well. But when it comes to worship, I am incredibly skeptical of any approach that basically says the people that don't come to our church don't like X, therefore we shouldn't do X with regard to worship. Now, there's obviously a ton of stuff that churches do that is self-destructive and not helpful to the growth of their congregation that they don't have to do, right? So take care of your building.
Right.
Have you know, those of us who serve congregations that were built in the 1950s when Lutherans were going through their whole God hates natural light in our sanctuaries, you know, architectural movement. Like, that's a challenge, right? It's a challenge to try and fix. Is people will probably like sitting in your sanctuary more if it's not dark,
right?
If they can actually see things, if they can see 9 inches in front of their face, that's a good thing. And, you know, clean your bathrooms. Have people be friendly to them when they come in. So stuff like that, obviously, that has nothing to do with your worship. But people who don't have the Holy Spirit don't know what worship should be.
Mm.
So
yeah, solid point.
So so they should not be the ones that you're deferring to tell you what you how you should worship. So because they don't know the answer, but.
Right.
But the other thing is, and this is the thing that really drives me nuts about so much of the church growth movement, people lie.
Mm-hmm.
If you go and you ask, and I've heard of congregations doing this. I know of congregations that have done this, where they've gone out and they've surveyed their community, mm-hmm. of the people who don't come there and say, well, what do you want in a church? Why don't you want to come? And they go, oh, maybe if you did this, then I would come. And they lie. Everybody lies. If you ask massive numbers of people,
mm-hmm.
any sort of question that implies that there's a right answer that they're supposed to give, they will lie. Mm-hmm. So this is why when you look at church attendance statistics, right, and the percentage of people who supposedly go to church every week, and it's not what the figures claim it is at all.
Right.
So if you compare, if you had a town of 100 people and you surveyed all of them, and 45% of them said, I go to church every week, maybe 18% of them go to church every week.
Right.
And those who say they go every other week actually go three times a year, four times a year, whatever. And those who say they go four times a year haven't gone in 15 years, right? What they mean is like, oh, I was supposed to go. If I did go, when I get around to it, that's what my church attendance will be.
Yeah.
But there's no, they lie to you. So, like, what I can never figure out about this is, have the guys who fall for this, didn't they ever ask out a girl and have her say no?
Right.
And you 100% know that the reason she gives you for why she doesn't want to go out with you is a lie?
Yeah.
Right? So a girl says to you, oh, I think you're great. I'm just not ready for a relationship right now. And then Ryan Gosling walks in the room and asks her out. And she's like, I'm ready to get married in 5 minutes. Right? So it's not that she's not ready for a relationship. She's not ready for a relationship with you because she's not attracted to you. For whatever reason that might be. That might be your fault. That might be her fault. But whatever the reason is, she's not going to tell you that. People aren't going to tell you, the reason I don't come to church is because I hate Jesus.
Right.
But that's why they don't come to church. Mm-hmm. Because they hate Jesus.
Here's the
thing.
Because
they don't think they need his forgiveness.
Here's the thing. I drink too much. I do drugs. And I'm living with, like, my third girlfriend here. And
right.
I really don't want to stop doing any of those right. things.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but what they'll tell you is, well, maybe if you had, like, people stand up for too long. Right. Yeah. So I used to grow up to church. I grew up Catholic. And we were always, like, standing up and sitting down. I want a church where there's not all that standing up and sitting down. But then they don't come.
Right.
So we find this all the time in other aspects of the church life, right? So if a pastor goes through his membership roles and he calls up all the people that haven't been there in a long time and he says, why haven't you been coming to church? And they go, pastor, I'm working on Sundays. I got this job. I got to be at work. There's nothing I can do about it. And you go, okay, what if we had a service on Saturday night or Sunday night or Monday night, whatever it might be, would you come to that? And they go, oh, yeah, I would come to that. And then you have it, and they don't come because the reason they don't. So, like, do they have to work on Sundays, on Sunday mornings? Well, maybe, sure, but the reason they have to work on Sundays is because when they went to get a job and their boss said, hey, can you work on Sunday mornings? They said, yep, I don't have anything else going on at that time because
right.
it wasn't important to them. So they're not going to tell you. This reminds me of a script I wrote a long time ago and then I lost it. I got to rewrite it at some point. I think it was called Veridart, where the idea was it was like a blowgun for pastors that makes you tell the truth. And so people give you the line and then you shoot them with it. And you're talking to people like, I haven't seen you, in about 9 months, everything going all right. And they go, oh yeah, we've just been really busy. And and then it's, well, pastor, we just hate Jesus. That's why we're not coming.
You should make that a Lutheran satire video.
That's supposed to be, yeah. I'll get around to that at some point. But yeah, so the idea that unbelievers know what they want and that they really want to come to church, but golly gee, this aesthetic thing that they don't even know if it's there because they don't know what you do.
Yeah,
like I go to church a lot. I'm a very church oriented guy, and I don't. If I drive past a church, and that just calls itself like Faith Church,
right?
I don't have any idea as to what's going on in there. I don't know what church body it is. I don't know what they believe. I don't know how they worship. I don't know anything about it. So the idea that there are factors I can probably wager a guess but
they're
the
Baptist.
Idea that right yeah but the idea that people who don't ever go to church don't have any curiosity about that even know what you're doing so the idea that they're not coming because you're not offering them what they need presumes that they know what you're offering, which is just not remotely true. So that is a very odd thing to me, that you don't let unbelievers tell you how to worship. You worship the way that you worship with what the scriptures give you to proclaim, and you use the best of what you have. You know, so with arguments about, you know, contemporary worship versus traditional worship and all that stuff, I think in a lot of ways we don't have the right argument, which is just simply, well, use the best stuff that we have. Right. Use the hymns that do the best job of proclaiming Christ. And look, there's a lot of 16th century, 17th century hymns that didn't survive because they probably weren't any good. And it's like how I feel when I'm going through listening to the radio, which I don't do a whole lot, but I'm an old person, so I will sometimes still listen to radio stations. And you'll get to the classic rock station and Sugar Ray will come on. And you're going, guys, we've had like 25 years to realize that they're not good. We don't have to listen to this anymore. This shouldn't have survived. Like, show me the music that was on the radio in 1995, and now today I can tell you this is the stuff we want to, like, put in the time capsule. This is the stuff, you know, we want to preserve. So a lot of stuff you recognize later on doesn't work. It's not that great. So you take the best stuff that you have. And likewise, you should take stuff, your church music should be able to be sung by the whole congregation. This is one of the weird things to me about people have this idea that typically, you know, what we typically call contemporary Christian music, that it's somehow much more engaging for people. They don't sing it. They sit there and they watch someone else sing it because it's written in the style of pop music where you where it's performed and where you have a singer who's a professional singer and has the range to sing it. Hymns have, like, you have to have an octave range to be able to sing a hymn. You need a 2-octave range to sing the national anthem, right? That's why no one sings the national anthem when you go to baseball games and things of that nature. So if you're having music you need a 2+ octave range to be able to sing, you got to be a power tenor to be able to sing it. Well, half the ladies can't sing it, half the guys can't sing it.
Yeah.
So have music that people can actually sing, and I also think it's good for the church to sound like church. So when you walk into the church, it should look different than everywhere else in town. And it should smell different than everywhere else in town. And it should feel different and taste different. And it should sound different. And if what we have I'm not kind of drawing a hard line here about what type of instrumentation people use. But there is stuff that's just sonically evocative of something other than Jesus. Right. I mean, so, you know, you can listen to guitar riffs and you go, that sounds like 1987. Right. That doesn't sound like heaven. And maybe there's a way to incorporate but you're putting a stumbling block in front of people that I just simply think doesn't need to be there. So, and I think too, like we one of the things that we should always do is solve the right problem in the church. So we're oftentimes good at diagnosing the problem, but bad at coming up with the solution, right? So the problem is, people don't like all those old stuffy hymns that you Lutherans sing. And you go, why not? And they go, because they think they're boring. And you go, that's a them problem, not a hymn problem. That's not a problem with the hymns. If you're bored by beautiful poetry that confesses the gospel, that's a problem with you.
Right.
And the solution to that problem is not stop doing the thing that's good and give people fluff. The solution to that problem is actually pay attention to the words that you're singing and stop being an enthusiast who thinks that by virtue of an emotional response that's evoked by soaring guitar solos or whatever it might be, that's how you somehow connect with God rather than through his actual word.
How do you handle people that's all good for you, but I know where me and Jesus are and I need the emotional whatever he speaks to me, etc. How do you approach that?
Yeah, my approach to that is everybody is the same.
Okay.
Faith for everybody works the same way.
Okay.
There aren't some people where their faith is strengthened by words, and other people where their faith is strengthened by emotional experiences. The Bible is very, very clear about what strengthens and nurtures and grows faith. And that's the word of God. That's the forgiveness of sins proclaimed to you. Hmm. Now, obviously, there can be other things associated with that that people can glom onto, but that's not the actual substance of the thing. Hmm. So my response to people who think that way is essentially, well, you're wrong, and by the grace and the mercy of God, he has not allowed you to make shipwreck of your faith by not knowing where your faith comes from. Mm. But you are the same as everybody else. Your faith will be strengthened by the word. And the hymns that most clearly proclaim the word are the hymns that are best going to serve you in the long run. It doesn't, sure, everyone may have emotional attachments to things, and that's great. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't have those things. But you shouldn't think that the spices are the main, are the meat, mm-hmm. is kind of basically my approach with that. So that's a big thing in evangelical culture, yeah. is kind of this mindset of, I get to determine what grows my faith and what doesn't, which is a dangerous game to play.
It's very American, isn't it?
It's profoundly individualistic, right? Mm-hmm. So like, oh, I know, I figured out, I know what works to strengthen my faith and what doesn't. Yeah. And which I imagine it's probably like, people going on nutty diets and then going to their doctor and going, no, my body really responds to this well. And your doctor's going, well, it's because you're not eating food and, you know, you're ingesting poison or whatever right. it might be. So no, you're not different from other people in that your body needs fuel to live. And you're not different from other people in that you can't harvest what's not in something to feed yourself. So in the end, that's, yeah, you just look at that and you just say, well, yeah, look, I know that this is a major aspect of evangelical culture, that you kind of have to figure out your own path in terms of what really works for you and what gets you connected to God. But it's mysticism. It's a false view of how God actually works. You're connected to God by the word, and you should focus on that.
So we're coming up here on the end, and I want to thank you again for taking all this time with me.
My pleasure.
I had a couple questions that were requested I ask you. I told a group of Lutheran friends that I was going to have you on.
Okay.
And I got a couple of questions that were requested. So let me see here. Do you know Madeline Rose Craig on Twitter? She's great.
The name sounds familiar. I'm sure I do.
She wants to know, what were the origins of Lutheran satire?
Well, I've always liked making jokes, and I grew up loving sketch comedy and things of that nature. And in the very early days, there was a website called Extra Normal where you could do text to talk stuff. So I could just type in the dialogue, and I would kind of craft the humor around the fact that the program couldn't pronounce words correctly, and it was all very robotic. So if you wrote dialogue that sounded funny in a robotic voice, mm-hmm. so I was able to do the videos very fast, and I could do one a week back in those days. But eventually the technology died, and I wanted to move on to more substantial things. So that was kind of where I'd been wanting to do something like that for a while, and then a friend of mine alerted me to that software, and that was enough for me to be able to kind of get the ideas across. And then a little bit before then, I wrote an article, and I don't even remember at this point what it was about, but it was a satirical article about something. And my cousin Mark, who's one of my best friends, dubbed me the king of Lutheran satire. So that was where the name came
roll
from.
Roll credits. So, there it is.
That's right.
Wow. So Rachel wants me to ask you about Lutheran snark. because we can be snarky. Some people say we're mean, and they're wrong. Why make snark your brand?
Anyone who says we're mean is an idiot and a loser.
Yep, agreed.
In the most loving way. I've just come to recognize there are certain people who temperamentally cannot handle snark. Mm-hmm. And they cannot conceive of it as being anything other than mean-spirited. And what I do is not for them, and that's fine. And I certainly trust that God will provide them a very kind, tender-hearted pastors who won't hurt their feelings in the way that I do. Mm-hmm. But snark is helpful in that it alerts people to the fact that you have something to say. Mm. So I kind of equate it to, it's confrontational, not in the sense of punching someone in the face, but to kind of like walking up to someone and just sort of flicking them in the nose. And so mm-hmm. they kind of do yeah. that. And then you get their attention so that you can recognize that you're talking about something. But there's snark all over the place
yeah.
in the scriptures. Jesus uses it when he's talking with the Pharisees. Paul uses it when he's talking with the Judaizers. It's all over the place in the Old Testament as well. I mean, you look at David's speech before he goes to battle with Goliath. It's like a WWE promo where he's just going off on, you know, he's going to give his body to the birds of the air and stuff. So the idea that the Christian faith should never be confrontational, or that we shouldn't employ humor or kind of a comedic way of speaking, is a rule that our Lord and the apostles and the prophets break frequently. So I think it's kind of part of the general problem of people mistaking politeness for love. And I definitely don't think those two are the same thing, that you can deeply and profoundly love people. And I do. I mean, that's from my perspective, that's very much why I'm doing the thing that I'm doing, is because I want everyone to know the truth and to believe it. And I think this can be a very helpful way for a lot of people to recognize that we Lutherans have something to say. That, I mean, to me, that is the number of people I've had who've contacted me throughout the years telling me that they knew nothing at all about Lutherans, and then all of a sudden they came across this and they're going, well, then what do Lutherans believe? And then they started going to, you know, their local LCMS congregation and became Lutheran, and it's great. That's happened a number of times, and I think in a lot of ways it's because Lutherans have historically not been great about kind of just walking into the town square and flicking people in the nose and saying, I have something important to say, shut up and listen to me.
Right. I was on Twitter earlier today speaking with, I think he's a Presbyterian pastor, and he said that he has a rule that you can only be as brash as Luther if you're also as smart as Luther. And when he tweeted that at me, you were the first person I thought of, and I was like, Pastor Feeney, it fits.
No, I don't think I'm as brash as Luther, because Luther would say some really insane stuff. So I don't think I've ever actually been as like I've never. Luther used to call the Pope Fardass,
right?
And I've never called Joel Osteen, you know, Mr. Poopy McPoopy Mouth or something, you know, like that. So I suppose I've never been as brash as Luther, because I'm definitely not as smart as Luther. So I will try to, and I think that's a good rule. I will try to keep my brashness
on par.
Well south of Luther's at least most egregious insults.
Last one, seminarian Ian Hines, he's in his fourth year at St. Louis, I believe, wants to know, what are a few of the most important lessons you've learned throughout your time in ministry? So just end on the biggest, most complicated question I possibly could.
Yeah. One of the things I've learned is that when you're out of time to answer a question, uh-huh. those are the kinds of questions that you get. Mm-hmm. One of the things I would say is, I actually talked about this earlier. One of the things is, don't underestimate how clearly you're going to have to connect the dots for people, that in particular in your preaching of the law, that you need to be very, very, very specific and very clear for people. And so that's one aspect. Another aspect is, once your people know, once they have learned throughout the years of you being up in the pulpit, once they know that you will never, ever, ever walk out of the pulpit without forgiving their sins, once they know that you will always 100% of the time bind up every wound that you open, you can say anything. Hmm. And I mean that in a positive sense. So I've known a lot of guys throughout my years who are afraid to preach about certain things from the pulpit. And when you reliably preach the gospel, you can preach against anything. Because as long as people know that that's not going to be the end, that they're going to get the forgiveness of sins, their ears are trained to not respond just with immediate defensiveness, shut down, not listen. Now, I mean, of course, you'll have, you know, anecdotal examples to the contrary, throughout your ministry, but not a lot. And as an overall trend, that's definitely the case. So those would be a couple of really big things. And then maybe one other thing would be, you'll figure out pretty quickly what to expect. The only thing that will shock you is ingratitude. Hmm. So like infighting in the congregation and people's sins and their struggles and their temptations, that's not going to shock you at all. But like the behavior of the kids whose parents you bury will, if you're not ready for that, that will shock you. And that can be the most demoralizing thing that there is. But the important thing to remember in all of that is it's never about you. It really isn't. That there's that level of ingratitude because they have not begun to understand that they're actually sinners in need of Christ's forgiveness and mercy. And so that's your job. But the more that you preach the gospel, the more that you teach your people that they know you will, it's that you're as reliable as like Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes, that he's going to get the better of Elmer Fudd, right, or Yosemite Sam. That's how reliable the preaching of the gospel is for you. So that if Bugs Bunny is at the end of the diving board and Yosemite Sam is, you know, sawing off the platform of the diving, is on the platform sawing it off, the plank's going to stay up in the air and the platform is going to drop. That's when they know that that's going to happen. That's where real ministry happens, and that's where being able to build real relationships with your sheep happens.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for doing this with me again. This was really great. Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, I look forward to being on your 10 for 10 interview. And next up,
I get, you know, what's really annoying is that I have to finish the series because I said I would, and no one's watching it.
Oh, I love them.
I mean, well, thank you. I'm glad that you do.
Yeah, no, I've enjoyed them.
Yeah, no, I'm planning on doing one with my wife for this program she runs called Swaddling Clothes.
Okay.
Where we'll talk about that, but also I think it's hilarious. So Katie does not watch my videos.
Yeah, right.
She doesn't. She thinks I'm funny when I say things that are funny to her, but she doesn't. But it's just not necessarily her thing. So the gist of the interview will be a little bit talking about the program she runs, and then I'm just going to quiz her on trivia for Lutheran satire videos, and she's going to get absolutely everything wrong.
Yeah, excellent, excellent.
And I think it's because Lutherans are nerdy, and so when some nerdy kid, you're with your husband at something, and some nerdy kid comes up to him and is like fangirling over it, you're just going, I don't, like, I fold that guy's underwear. I don't understand. I don't get it. That is, by the way, one of my favorite subgenres of, very, very small subgenre of YouTube clips is, I like hearing really, really cool celebrities tell stories about how their kids are embarrassed by them. I remember watching an interview with Hugh Jackman where he was talking about his son, he's at the beach with his son, and his son was trying to pick up some girl, trying to impress some girl. And he's like, all right, Dad, we're going to be walking by, but when we're walking by, don't embarrass me. And his dad's Wolverine.
Right.
It's, just utterly jacked and you're terrified that the coolest guy in the world is going to, embarrass you. It was great.
So there was maybe another minute or two of us chit-chatting and laughing, but somehow I lost the end of the audio only. But thankfully, the rest of the interview was saved. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of Lutheran Answers, and I will catch you on the next one.